unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. What sanctuary? When? Welcome to Probe. We continue our series on the Gospel, 1844, and Judgment. And today we are dealing with a specific chapter that actually gave rise to the great disappointment and the birth of the Adventist Church, you might say. So we're going to deal with some pretty volatile stuff here because 1844 was a long ways away. My conversation partners are Dave Thomas and Paul Dibdo from the School of Theology. Welcome.
Thank you, Alan.
Now, let's get down to work. What sanctuary? When? That's a very naughty question to ask so bluntly, but...
Why do you say it's a naughty question? It's a very important question.
What is very important?
And it's one that has several possible answers.
Okay. What are the possible answers? Let's lay those out.
The one I know best is the one that I grew up understanding.
Uh-huh.
That there is again a cosmic dimension to this, and just as we saw various aspects of the plan of redemption illustrated in the sanctuary or the tabernacle in the Old Testament, we see that in a heavenly one or on a cosmic level. And Adventists, especially after the Great Disappointment, came to understand the sanctuary as a heavenly one.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we look at this particular chapter, let's just ask the question, put it back in Daniel's day, disregarding all questions of dating and so on. But as you read the narrative, when the angel says unto 2,300 days the sanctuary will be cleansed or restored, talks about the abomination of desolation, to use some of the old language, what sanctuary was Daniel clearly thinking about? Which one was it?
Well, I would think he was thinking about the one in Jerusalem that used to be there.
Mm-hmm. It was destroyed in 586. He couldn't see any other sanctuary. That's the one that he was focused on. Now, we'll point out in the next chapter when we deal with Daniel 9 next week that he was worried that maybe that sanctuary wasn't going to be restored in the way that Jeremiah had predicted. But it's amazing, because this is where the interpreters of Scripture really separate themselves all over the place. Now, before we talk about some of those differences, let's go to chapter 8, verses 19 to 22, and see the interpretation. But let me give a synopsis first of what's going on here. There are two beasts, not wild ones like you had in chapter 7. These now are beasts with religious significance, a ram and a he-goat. They duke it out, to use a contemporary translation. The he-goat comes out on top, and there is a prominent king, and then out of that mess comes someone who pollutes the sanctuary. Okay? And it concludes by saying that in 2,300 days, then the sanctuary will be restored to its rightful place. Now, verse 15 says, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I tried to understand it. Then someone said, understand. I heard a human voice by the Uli calling, Gabriel, help this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I became frightened and fell prostrate. But he said to me, understand, O mortal, that the vision is for the time of the end.
Mm-hmm.
What do you suppose Daniel felt when he heard those words? Where was the time of the end as far as Daniel was concerned?
I don't know, maybe you're suggesting the end of the Babylonian captivity.
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly the way he linked it with the restoration.
Yeah, and then especially when you think about Jeremiah and how he related to that.
Mm-hmm. 70 years just about up, mm-hmm. See? But now let's look at the interpretation. This is one of the rare places in Scripture where Scripture actually interprets itself explicitly. Now, we've had some of that in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7.
Yeah.
That's the same principle, but here, let's see how far we can go where interpreters agree. As he was speaking to me, I fell into a trance. face to the ground. Then he touched me and set me on my feet and said, Listen, I will tell you what will take place in the period of wrath, for it refers to the appointed time of the end. There it is again. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. The male goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between its eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others came, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. All interpreters of all schools would be perfectly clear what that means up to that point.
And now, let's just be specific. It's talking about who? Alexander the Great?
Alexander the Great and the four divisions of his kingdom,
yeah.
The four generals.
Yeah.
Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But then everybody scatters across the hillside as they go from there. Now, let me spell out just a bit of why this is problematic. Daniel was thinking about the sanctuary in Jerusalem. That much is quite clear. But when you move along in the history, there came a time when Antiochus Epiphanes, who grew out of the Seleucid kingdom, in other words, out of one of those four, when he came from Egypt in very poor emotional conditions, let's say, angry because the Romans said, you get out of here, and so he had no other choice but to get out. He came to Jerusalem and battered things like you wouldn't believe. He took over the temple, and for a period of 3 years, desecrated the temple. They actually put up an altar to Zeus over the altar of burnt offering. They offered pig on there. All of this in the Jerusalem temple. Now, this Antiochus Epiphanes was seen by the Jews in the period of the Maccabees. We have the books to Maccabees. Clearly as applying to the book of Daniel. And they used all the language from Daniel 8. Now, let me ask you, is that a legitimate way to make an application? Whether or not that is original intention, is it legitimate when your sanctuary is being polluted simply to pick up the language and say, this applies? Now, that's a loaded question, so answer it cheerfully.
I think so. I mean, that's, again, that's what we do with Scripture in general. I read the Psalms, and they're... passages there which parallel my experience, and so that psalm speaks to me, and I use that language then, and I think what you're describing is something that indeed is legitimate.
Although I would not want to limit this discussion to Antiochus Epiphanes.
No, by no means.
No.
See, if you take the principles behind it, see, then at any time when the sanctuary is being polluted by an evil character, it would apply.
But also, I don't see any cosmic dimension to Antiochus Epiphanes to speak of. You know, there's a historical one, and maybe as the temple relates to God, there's something of a cosmic dimension. But I see in Daniel a much bigger cosmic play. And so, if this is limited only to Antiochus Epiphanes, what do we do with the cosmic issues that are playing out between God and Satan?
I think you're absolutely right, Dave. This is a limited perspective. But if you were living at that time, you wouldn't be thinking so much cosmic perspective as what's happening in my church. Now, if you take the different interpretations, those who would put some of this clear to the future, see, our dispensationalist friends would put some of this stuff clear in the future during the 1,000 years. Our preterist friends who do not believe that this is prophecy at all would put the whole thing in the context of the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, we'll talk a bit more about that in the future, but that possibility of multiple applications is certainly raised. And I heard a presentation once, it's really quite fascinating. In Matthew 24, remember the phrase of Jesus? When you see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, let the reader understand. I was listening to a presentation by two well-known scholars, Trevor Childs and Paul Hansen. Childs from Yale and Hansen from Harvard. And Childs was making the argument for multiple applications. And when he finished, Hansen came out, and it's great fun to listen to the big boys when they quarrel like this. He came out and argued, Childs, if you take multiple applications, you give license to every single apocalyptic sect in California. And he's right.
Mm-hmm.
People can pick that up and can run with it. And Childs came back, I couldn't disagree with you more thoroughly. So it was very interesting to see that wrap up. But if you take Matthew seriously, when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, that is a clear indication that the Antiochus-only interpretation is not adequate,
yes.
Is not complete.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There is one which is still to come.
Yeah.
So I think we need to keep that in mind.
So we shouldn't dismiss Antiochus from history.
No.
No.
And I think we can even see as a possible application here.
Mm-hmm.
When time moves on, you get to see that. But now let's talk just a few minutes here about how Adventists came to the 1844 conclusion, because I think that's a crucial part of our story. How in the world did they take this passage, applying not to Antiochus, not the destruction of Jerusalem, but to 1844? How did that happen?
Well, there's several ways to get us started on a train of thought, Alden. You want to?
Well, yeah, let me just... And we don't have a lot of time. We'll have to pick this up. We do have some other lessons on this. But what happened was that as time moved on through the medieval period, you come to a period around the 1840s when the day-year principle was being invoked.
Yeah, and also the calculations about the time of the end being linked to 1798.
That's right. And I have an amazing quotation here from a source. Actually, it's Burned Over District, Whitney R. Cross. He's not writing from any particular church perspective. He said, all Protestants expected some grand event around 1843, and no critic from the Orthodox side took any serious issue on the basic principles with Miller's calculations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Miller is the one who calculated the initial calculations, 1843. In other words, at that point in time,
there was a general expectation.
And everybody found that it made perfectly good sense.
Mm-hmm.
So what sanctuary is there left? All the others have been destroyed.
Sanctuary in heaven.
Well, that's true. But initially they thought the earth was the sanctuary.
Okay.
Yeah, they thought
the earth itself.
The earth itself was the sanctuary.
Yeah, and it would be cleansed by the return of Jesus,
Yeah.
Which they expected in 1843 and then 1844.
And you get so wrapped up with that that you overlook Jesus' statement that no man knows the day nor the hour. That's the question of my students. How could they be so blind? But it's easy to get wrapped into a particular point of view and overlook the correctives. Now, what happened after that, then they had to go back and study. They sensed God's hand was leading them, but they didn't have the answers. Now, we're going to have to leave the story right there because that clock is moving on. Next week, we're going to pick up Daniel 9, which is part of the same story. They're very closely linked, so I want to thank Dave and Paul for your contributions, and I want to thank Susan Michael, our program engineer, and all of you for listening in. For Probe, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194, or email us at probe@wwc.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll be here next week at this time with Probe.